So there's a line that's going around right now saying that AI is not going to take your job, but the person who knows how to use AI is going to take your job. And I think that's probably pretty accurate.
Welcome to the Building Cyber Resilience Podcast by Resilience. I'm Dr. Ann Irvin, Chief Data Scientist and Vice President of Product Management.
And I'm Richard Sierson, Chief Risk Officer. That's Bryce Goodman, Chief Strategist of AIML and Advisor for the Advanced Energy Materials at the Defense Innovation Unit at the U.S. Department of Defense. This idea of whether machine learning will supersede human knowledge and the roles we hold in society is a hot topic across most industries.
If we look at machine learning, like, it's amazing what we're able to do, but if you look at the sheer amount of data that we have to feed in to it, it actually isn't always a particularly efficient system for doing certain things.
But the reality of what this competition with AI means and what it requires to actually become a threat or be a valuable tool is nuanced.
My name is Chris Finan, and I have seen great results from deep learning models once you hit that inflection point of data in bringing together disparate data sets for sort of a holistic picture of risk. And I think that this is an area in security that we're now beginning to see the promise of that approach pay off. And I think it will only continue as the instrumentation gets better, as the insurers drive more of that instrumentation.
As the Chief Operating Officer of Act Zero AI and Chief Revenue Officer of Symmetry Systems, Inc., Chris has been pioneering groundbreaking ideas in AI in Silicon Valley for nearly a decade.
I find myself more and more focusing on scaling challenges associated with basically the bad guys using AI to mount higher volumes of attacks and more sophisticated attacks. And then on the defender side, figuring out how to leverage artificial intelligence to have a more precise response that's more efficient and can find the needle in the haystack more efficiently for the attack, for the defender. So it's very AI-centric as I think about where the adversary is headed next and what's the next set of defensive technologies that need to be built.
When it comes to the insurance industry, one of the most important defensive roles is that of the underwriter, and their role becomes significantly more interesting as we enter this AI era. Underwriting is both art and science. It's qualitative and quantitative, objective and subjective.
In fact, underwriters are not unlike the baseball scouts in Moneyball. They consider run-of-the-mill statistics like runs batted in, on-base average, and myriads of other data. They also consider countless subjective factors. And not to spoil the plot, but at the end of the day, they were awful. So when Billy Bean, the A's general manager, brought in a statistician, what happened? The Oakland A's achieved the longest consecutive game winning streak in history. It holds strong to this day. Unfortunately, the A's haven't retained their edge. All teams have their quants now, and scouts have persisted. The question I want to explore in today's episode is, what will be the fate of the underwriter? Will they persist like the scouts, or are they headed for a ChatGPT-enabled demise?
Let's do it. But before we get into the weeds, I think we need to define some terms. Bryce Goodman, who we heard open the show, wears many hats. Entrepreneur, technologist, philosopher, strategist, and consultant, walks us through the difference between traditional AI and generative AI.
So I'll switch into professorial mode for a moment. So artificial intelligence, the term goes back to the 1950s. There was a conference in Dartmouth, and the original idea was, how can we create machines that exhibit intelligent behavior? And that's basically the definition of AI. And so that ends up being a moving definition, in that things that we once thought were associated with human intelligence, once we can get machines to do them, we often cease to call that AI, right? So there are lots of things today, like, for example, chess algorithms that you might play against on your computer that a few years ago would have been cutting edge AI research projects, but nowadays is something that you may not even consider AI. But going back to the 1950s, there were, even at that time, sort of two approaches to building these AI systems. One was using rules and symbolic logic, and this was called expert systems. And the idea there was that you could go and consult with experts in their fields, like say a doctor, and ask that doctor, okay, when you look at a patient, what are the things that you look for? And depending on what you see, how would you classify them in terms of, you know, disease manifestation, et cetera? And this is the kind of system that you have within things like TurboTax, right? Where you input your income and expenses and whatever, and it kicks out what you owe in taxes. That's an expert system. It's a form of AI, and it has a set of rules that have been hard-coded into it. And this is great for all sorts of applications, totally useful, and especially nice about it is that it's very transparent, right? If you want to change a parameter, you just go in and change it. So if the tax code gets updated, no problem. We can go in, we can clearly change that parameter because we know exactly how the rules are relating to the output. It's human-generated rules applied to data. Machine learning takes a totally different approach. So in machine learning, you're actually using the data to generate rules. So the algorithm is working to minimize a loss function or maximize an optimization function. And it's doing this by iteratively trying out different values across variables. And you know, there are different sorts of algorithms like neural networks, for example. In a neural network, you have the network gets updated through a process called backpropagation, and it's able to track the error between what was predicted to be the output and what the actual output is. And this process goes on and on iteratively. And ideally, you get to a point where you've, you know, lowered that that loss function to an acceptable level. So in that case, you know, the paradigm is totally different. We're not applying rules to data. We're using that data to generate the rules, so to speak. And this has advantages in terms of the sorts of data that you can use. So, you know, you're not restricted to tabular data. You can take anything that can be converted into some set of, mathematical representation. In theory, can be, you know, subject to machine learning. So whether that's, you know, taking a picture and converting the pixels into arrays, or taking words and converting them into vectors or embeddings, it's a far more, in that sense, kind of data agnostic type of AI system. And recently, a lot of the interest has been in these generative AI systems. You know, generative AI, I guess the most recent wave of generative AI, or it was generative adversarial networks, and that I think was Ian Goodfellow. Back when he was at OpenAI, I believe, came up with, and that was a way of generating images. We now have, you know, things like Stable Diffusion that uses other techniques to also generate images, and then of course we have ChatGPT and the like, which, you know, we can use to generate text, and these are all based on neural networks and machine learning methods. The fundamental, you know, backpropagation and something called gradient descent still applies. So it's pretty wild to see, you know, just how far we can stretch these relatively simple techniques in terms of the kinds of problems that they can solve. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen in the past few years is this phenomenon of scaling laws. So, you know, normally we might expect that if we feed more and more data into these algorithms, we make them bigger and bigger, there should be some sort of tapering off in terms of improvement, right? But that's not at all what we see. We see that we are consistently getting better and better improvement as we scale up. And there isn't, you know, an obvious limit to what that will lead to. So that's been a sort of tremendous thing that's the reason why I think these generative technologies came, frankly, faster than anybody thought that they would. I think if you compare where we were at a few years ago to where we're at now, it's just pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, I agree. The last 10 years have progressed really quickly in this respect. I'd like to, I don't know, debate or push back a little bit or get maybe some more hot takes from you on the maybe the middle ground between the two ends of the spectrum that you just described. I think we've swung pretty far culturally in the direction of sort of liking these purely, quote unquote, purely data-driven approaches to AI and ML. But I think, and I'm quoting, I think Brian Chesky, the CEO of Airbnb, I heard say on a podcast just a couple weeks ago, we use enormous amounts of data about individual user interaction with Google search to figure out very simple things about their intent. So, you know, we look at 100, 1,000 most recent search history to try to figure out, is someone about to move houses? Are they about to move across the country? You know, and we try to infer this based on what they're looking at. They're looking at housing, they're looking at moving companies, they're looking at boxes, you know, whatever it is, looking up new, I don't know, the DMV, you know, and other places, to just try to figure out if we should advertise to them a moving company, you know, in the place where they're headed or something like that. And he said, why don't we just ask people if they're moving? You know, it struck me that he sort of alluded to the user of the system as an expert, not the expert training the model, although, you know, that line even isn't totally clear. But I'm curious if you see us swinging back in the other direction at all and sort of starting to value, you know, value the expert in the same way that we've sort of increasingly value the quote unquote purely data-driven approaches to ML.
Yeah, I mean, you raise an interesting point, maybe just about the nature of online advertising writ large. I have a good friend named Tim Wang who wrote a book a few years ago that was just about the phenomenon of online advertising and how we don't actually know how effective it is. I mean, nobody other than these companies knows how effective it is, and that's why they're able to charge advertisers what they're able to charge.
Yeah, and even they're misleading everyone, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a purposely opaque system. Mm-hmm. I think on the AI side, there certainly the idea that we have completely moved away from expert or rule-based systems towards data-driven systems is totally wrong. So self-driving cars that you see on the road, yes, those have sensors that are using, you know, data-driven things on their detections, but there are also, you know, very much rule-based systems that are at play that are, you know, telling that car how to drive. You know, similarly, I have a friend that works at one of the air taxi companies. This one has not yet gone bankrupt. And he said to me straight out, he's like, if we're trying to get this certified by the FAA, there's absolutely no way that we're going to be relying on machine learning. Right. And that's because machine learning has a certain level of opacity to it, because instead of having a human programmer go in and set the rules and set an explicit decision making, you know, paradigm, instead, as I said, you're sort of letting that be statistically generated through this iterative process. So we don't have the same level of transparency. And then there are other people who argue. Gary Marcus, I think, is one of them, that, you know, even if we look at machine learning, like, it's amazing what we're able to do. But if you look at the sheer amount of data that we have to feed in to it, it actually isn't always a particularly efficient system for doing certain things. So, you know, like, let's say we want to do modeling of a physical system. Like, yes, we can feed in lots of observations of that physical system, but it may be a lot easier to just put in, like, physics parameters, right? And then, you know, proceed that way. So I don't think it's a matter of, like, one is going to completely supersede the other.
Bryce's points underscore how the impact of AI and ML are directly correlated with large data sets and inputs. While underwriters certainly have access to some data, there is room for improvement. Chris Finnan, who we heard earlier discussing how deep learning is giving us a holistic picture of risk, sees this opportunity for optimization as a net benefit. But the trinity of supply, demand, and the adversary in security makes capitalizing on this opportunity uniquely complex.
I think you've got the sort of democratization, right, of security analysis and workflows. Without a doubt, this technology is proving that it is able to make problems much more approachable and, you know, abstract away a lot of the specific knowledge required to be able to solve problems and perform analysis, right? And I think without a doubt, you can expect to see that across every type of operational workflow, and including security ops. And, you know, we've already seen, you're already starting to see some of these security applications and sort of ops applications come to the fore. So, you know, it's a smart assistant, right? And it can take very technical queries and translate them into natural language very easily, right? It is a great translation layer, and it is a very extensible one. So I think we know that it will lower the barrier to entry for analysts. And I think, you know, I could tell you in the government at DARPA, I really focused on this problem because we had a finite talent pool available. You know, think about it, as hard as it is for us here in industry to attract talented analysts to come and work on this problem set when you're competing with a lot of other more well-funded companies and larger companies. That's a very finite talent pool to get. You want to do everything that you can to use technology to sort of expand your access to the talent pool. I think generative AI will help leap that forward, right? And will make security ops much more accessible, you know, as a problem set, just in terms of how you interface with the environment. So I think that is absolutely a good thing. That will benefit both defenders and attackers, of course. Right now, many more people will be able to, you know, move from traditional fraud into online fraud and cyber attacks because of the same tooling. So, you know, we can expect that to be the case as well. I think the second part of your question is really interesting, and I think it's an open question, which is, will large language models make security analysis more efficient, right? Or create new efficacies? And, you know, I think that is very much an open question, just because, you know, we've seen a lot of the testing, at least with the open LLMs to date, and they've had mixed results compared to more traditional modeling, right? And human-based analysis for things like deep code analysis, static code testing, even things like, you know, verifying the configurations of infrastructure as code. LLMs are okay, at least so far. We haven't found one that has enough domain-specific training to really be more effective than other legacy modeling and human analysis techniques. I have no doubt that will likely come over time, but I think what you're at least what I've seen so far, is you do need an element of domain specific sort of state and context. It's not enough, right, to train something on the open internet with, you know, a trillion parameters. That's not necessarily going to get the context of any single tenant, right? What data matters, what systems are in that environment. You have to be able to bring a lot of that context in, and that's not something that's easy to do with just prompt engineering, right? You have to sort of train the model to have that context sort of deeply ingrained. And so we haven't seen that emerge yet. I have no doubt that we will over time. But, you know, one of the challenges with security is it's so dynamic. You don't just have the supplier and demand side of the market. You've got the adversary as well. Anytime you've got this sort of tripartite set of variables that are influencing the market, that's very difficult to train a model and to keep it up to speed in those sort of market idiosyncrasies. And I think that's why we're seeing the large language models today sort of struggle to provide deep security analytical benefit. Again, I have no doubt that will change as you get more domain-specific models that emerge. And I have a feeling that the investors are probably putting a lot of money into that right now. So I think that'll be interesting. And I think we'll start to see that in the next 12, 18, 36 months. You're going to start to see more of the domain-specific models emerge. And that's when things will really change and start to move quickly.
I love the way you framed it as lowering the barrier to entry of analyst positions, for example. I mean, a lot of folks worry that AI is coming for their jobs and, you know, we'll replace them. But the idea of lowering the barrier to entry, especially in a market where there's a real talent shortage, and lowering that barrier is really helpful, you know, is just really optimistic and feels right.
For the insurance industry's underwriter, the comparison of AI to the Moneyball statistician or quant role works so well here because of the way underwriters currently get various forms of telemetry. Whether it's scan data, dark web information, questionnaire results, or modeling, they're determining whether this entity they are evaluating is a risk their company should partner with. With the addition of AI and the subsequent lower barrier to entry into their talent pool, Chris says that how well underwriters can adopt and utilize AI to measure risk will determine their success.
Risk management to date, it's a very human-centric endeavor just because the collection of the data, it's time consuming and expensive, right? You're looking for control information. You're looking across systems. You know, I don't have to tell you all how difficult that can be, especially when you're coming into an organization for the first time. There's a lot of manual auditing involved, right? Because very typically the organization that needs this is not the organization that is instrumented and has the visibility across its infrastructure to really understand its risks, right? So you're dealing with varying degrees of instrumentation and visibility. So first you've got a data collection and normalization problem right off the bat. Unlike telemetry, right, is that is inherently normalized. Now, you know, analyzing for control gaps or control failures is much harder to do because again, it's not just going to vary a lot by infrastructure. It's going to vary by policy. You've got a lot more variant. And so it's just an inherently more difficult data set to understand. So now you have to start with some type of framework, which immediately you are limiting the view into that environment, right? Inherently because of the framework that you're using. Ideally, it's one that they've already implemented, like maybe a NIST or CSF or something. If not, you know, now you've got to go in and you've got to instrument that environment before you can even begin to collect the data. So, you know, I think you're just dealing with inherently smaller data sets. Now, all of that said, I will tell you, I have seen great results from deep learning models once you hit that inflection point of data in bringing together disparate data sets for sort of a holistic picture of risk. And I think that this is an area in security that we're now beginning to see the promise of that approach pay off. And I think it will only continue as the instrumentation gets better, as the insurers drive more of that instrumentation and more proactively so. I absolutely believe that this is an area where we can really move the needle in the industry in getting more proactive, more dynamic, and just frankly measuring much more to manage better.
Chris's positive outlook on how gathering more data will only improve AI's ability to measure risk is promising for insurance companies ready to disrupt legacy approaches. This theme of keeping the human at the center as the expert might not have played out for the scouts in Moneyball, but it's not too late for underwriters to rewrite their own plot. The best part? This approach benefits both the customer and the insurance company.
Well, look, without a doubt, it benefits the insurer. You know, I think the real challenge is you need to get the end user to understand that the benefits, because they're the ones that have to proactively do the work to be able to collect the data. You know, and so I think you have to make the benefits to that end user really stark, which, you know, you can't manage what you can't measure. So if you're giving them a data set that helps them shift left and get, frankly, a lot more efficient at where they're putting in place proactive controls, the benefits of that should be obvious. And, you know, I think every CISO has a problem of, okay, well, how do I measure sort of my posture, right? And how do I know if I'm investing enough in posturing, in my security posture? You know, I think every CISO that I've ever met has this question to some extent. They may have begun solving it, but they don't have the definitive solution. And so I think, to me, it's like pretty evident that there's going to be the benefit for the insurer, the reinsurer. And I think, you know, they work with big data problems, right? They understand the need for that. I think it's the end user. You got to have both supply and demand parts of this equation really in tune if you're going to end up creating a real paradigm shift in security where this becomes the norm. And I think it's that end user, that demand side, that ultimately has to be the one that's pushing for this. So I think just recognizing, as I know you at Resilience are beginning to do, thinking about how to make the benefits of that data set available and apparent to that end user so that they can begin to use that data, that's when I think you're going to start to see real liftoff.
But as with any innovative frontier, leveraging AI ML doesn't come without risk. After 15 years in the space, Bryce doesn't shy away from talking about the fact that AI's infinite possibilities are only equal to its potential to do harm.
there are problems that 15 years ago people were talking about that I was like, you know, you guys are basically playing science fiction. Like, this is, you know, fun to think about, but come on, this is ridiculous, right? So I was at the University of Oxford, which is where the Future of Humanity Institute is, and you had folks like Nick Bostrom there talking about superintelligence, right? And that's this idea that we might create an AI that is, you know, not just as smart as we are, but so much more intelligent than we are. And one of his concerns was that, you know, this AI may be so intelligent that we aren't smart enough to control it. And he gives this kind of fun example of, okay, you tell this super AI, I want you to make a factory that makes paperclips. And so you've just given it this very simple objective, make a bunch of paperclips. And the AI goes, okay, well, if that's my goal is to maximize the number of paperclips, first thing I want to do is make sure that I don't get turned off. And it looks around, it's like, well, humans are the only thing that can turn me off. So the first thing I do is I eliminate all humans. And, you know, it's this kind of example that is in one sense, like, kind of comical, but in another sense shows what he talks about as the orthogonality of goals. So we might give one of these super smart AI systems one goal, and then in it trying to accomplish that, it develops some like totally orthogonal sub goal. And this, again, like back in, you know, when he was talking about it, it was very hypothetical, but now we're actually starting to see things like this happening in the real world, right? Where we, you know, give a high level goal to a system and it starts developing its own weird sub goals. And I guess the fear is that, you know, one day AI could there's always going to be the risk of misuse, right? That's somebody who is intentionally using AI to do something bad. So somebody is intentionally using AI to perform cyber attacks or to try to generate a bioweapon or to generate disinformation. I mean, that's all bad and concerning. But arguably the thing that's even more concerning is misalignment. And that's the idea that we try to use AI to do something good, but we aren't able or don't have the foresight to actually give it instructions that are sufficiently precise to make sure it does what we want it to do. And it's that concern that led all of these folks from these leading AI labs to submit the, you know, their letter, I think, because that sort of threat, that's a novel threat to humanity. We've always, you know, we've had nuclear weapons and that's scary, but we've never had the possibility of an intelligence that we don't understand that could potentially get in a position to wreak untold havoc.
While this novel threat is concerning and misalignment is a real danger, Bryce's perspective isn't all dark. In fact, he's hopeful that if done right, it might give us humans an opportunity to become better at what we can uniquely accomplish.
I mean, one of the things that I say to people when they ask me, you know, what should I do in this age of AI is to say, you need to be more human, which sounds maybe corny, but what I mean by that is that I think for a long time, a certain kind of intelligence has been rewarded in our society, which is a very analytic intelligence, a very calculating intelligence, right? But then there are other, you know, sorts of intelligence that we have. For example, you know, a sense of navigating crises, for example, where it's not just a mere calculation, right? There's something, you know, some sort of intuition there, you know, some character features, etc. And I think that as we increasingly are able to get machines to take on these analytic tasks that we face, it's going to just highlight the importance of these other aspects of what it means to be a human, what it means to be one that possesses human intelligence and creativity and integrity and all of these other things. And just, you know, a historical example, it's kind of fun. When photography was invented, the reaction was, you know, this is going to be the end of art, right? That was a great fear that people had. And that made sense because up until then, the vast majority of art fell into either one of two categories. It was kind of decorative, or it was life. It was, you know, still lifes, right? It's like portraits, and the key kind of like way of valuing art was how much does this look like reality? Now you have a camera that can capture reality perfectly. So what does that mean for artists? Well, it meant that those who were painting no longer were constrained to just trying to recreate reality with fidelity, and could experiment with all sorts of other ways of creating art. And we get the impressionists and, you know, abstract art and all of this wonderful kind of artwork that just did not exist before photography. And I don't think that's a coincidence. And so my sort of hope is that we see a similar thing for human thought, that we are liberated from a lot of these analytic tasks that we're able to offload, and that as a result, we're able to flourish and become even more human humans.
The picture Bryce paints of the ultimate goal being to leverage AI so that we can flourish as humans is compelling. It also aligns with our approach to cyber resilience.
Yeah, I think resilience kind of ties into what I was just saying about trying to embrace those traits that are uniquely human traits in us, whether that's, you know, in our everyday life, but also, you know, especially in our work life. I think as we find that we can, you know, outsource things to machines, the correct response and the way to be resilient is to lean hard into those things that we can't outsource. Those things like, you know, empathy and leadership and a certain kind of creativity and integrity and all of those things that, you know, get labeled as quote unquote soft skills, but I think at the end of the day are going to be proven to be even more valuable in this AI-driven future.
Chris's advice colors in Bryce's vision for cyber resilience with actionable steps, and the critical reminder that planning, testing, and retesting is always a winning strategy. How do you think about cyber resilience? What should companies keep in mind? What's the most common thing that's overlooked? Any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you asked that question. I'm pretty old school the way I think about it. You know, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face, right? And I think, you know, the way you create resilience as you exercise for it. The way that you prepare for an incident is you exercise incidents. You know, you do the chaos monkey thing, right? You start turning things off. You make people have to react, you know, to a hypothetical incident. And then you test, you retest, you adapt. I don't think that there's magic. Sometimes we get so enamored with tech solutions that we forget layer 8. You know, and most of the challenges in an IR scenario tend to be human factors ones. Are your teams ready? Do they know who to call? Do you have a plan on the books? Have you exercised it? You know, so often what tends to happen is you get a lot of chefs in the kitchen in a scenario like that because, hey, this is a huge problem for the entire enterprise, right? And now all of a sudden the VPs are the ones that are, you know, being very directive on that call, and it can create a lot of stress. It can create a lot of unnecessary churn. And so, you know, one of the things that we really focused on was, hey, let's just make sure that we know exactly what we're going to do. We've got a plan. We've written it down. We have trained to it, and we continuously exercise for it. I think that's how you build resilience, is you practice and you build that muscle memory.
Striking a successful balance between humans and fully automated and data-driven AI is a dynamic, evolving challenge we face today in many fields, including cybersecurity and cyber risk management. But what both Bryce and Chris said that I found encouraging was the idea that AI isn't so much a threat to our roles as much as it is a tool that we must use intentionally and strategically.
The scouts in Moneyball were blown out of the water by the statisticians, but their role in baseball as a whole has persisted, and those that welcome quants as an aid to their job rather than a competitor have found success. If underwriters can learn from this plot, I think their pivotal role in our industry is set to only increase in value.
Thank you to Bryce and Chris for their time, expertise, and valuable insights, and to our production team at Come Alive Creative.
And thank you for listening.
Follow the Building Cyber Resilience podcast wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. We'll catch you on the next show.